Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice, recording at our studio in East County. Today we open with a story about Assembly Bill 805 and why critics contend this amounts to a power grab by the City of San Diego that would weaken the voices of East County and North County communities on the SANDAG board. Also hear about some new taxes taking effect this month that make it a lot more expensive to purchase cigarettes or vaping devices with nicotine. Our newsmaker interview today is with Gloria Chadwick, an elected member of the Grossmont Healthcare District Board and a former nurse at the Veterans Administration, or VA, as well as an internationally acclaimed wildlife artist. Now she's running for Congress in Duncan Hunter's district. She describes herself as a nurse warrior who will advocate for patients and constituents if elected. Hear what she has to say about healthcare reform, taking care of our veterans and military men and women, immigration, protecting our environment, and congressional ethics on today's show. We've also got news about some major product recall notices involving EpiPens used for allergic reactions and Ford pickup trucks that are rolling away. So stay tuned for these stories on today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show, where East County matters. Elected leaders in many local cities are gearing up to oppose a state bill that critics warn will weaken the voices and voting power of smaller cities on the San Diego Association of Governments, or SANDAG, board. The bill gives more power to the City of San Diego, which would make it more difficult for representatives from the county or other cities in the region to pass, block, or even place items on SANDAG's agenda. Assembly Bill 805 by San Diego Assemblywoman Lorena Gonzalez-Fletcher aims to overhaul the decision-making process at SANDAG to address problems that arose after the Prop A ballot measure. SANDAG presented faulty financial projections to voters that overestimated how much money that tax measure would bring in by about $8 billion. Gonzalez-Fletcher states, "Anyone who watched the Measure A debacle and its fallout knows it's time to reform the way we raise and spend transportation dollars in the San Diego region." She calls the current voting system arcane. AB 805 would eliminate the single-agency vote that lets each city in the region, as well as two transportation agencies, each cast a vote of equal weight. Under her system, each city's voting strength would be based on its population. In addition, it eliminates a requirement that no city receive more than 40% of the weighted vote, so potentially one city alone could gain a majority vote to pass anything if its population is large enough. Each city's mayor would be required to serve on SANDAG instead of having the option to appoint a council member. That's a problem for some small-town mayors with outside jobs who can't make SANDAG meetings. Under AB 805, the mayors of the largest two cities would permanently serve as chair and vice chair of SANDAG, rotating that position each term, meaning San Diego and Chula Vista would have all the clout to set agendas and run the meetings. The bill would also require an independent auditor and establishing an audit committee to oversee the audit work with an annual report to the legislature. Now, while most everyone agrees that some reforms are needed to prevent faulty data from being put before voters in the future, this proposal to shift the balance of power to San Diego and Chula Vista has sparked outrage among some local officials. La Mesa City Council member Christine Alicio wants La Mesa City Council to pass a resolution this week to oppose AB 805. In a memo to fellow council members, she writes, 17 of the 19 SANDAG member cities, through their primary SANDAG representatives, including the entire County Board of Supervisors, have voiced opposition to this bill. As written, it would restructure SANDAG in a manner where the County of San Diego and City of San Diego would control SANDAG. Alicio says San Diego and Chula Vista would no longer need to consult with other SANDAG member communities, which would put cities such as La Mesa El Cajon, Santee, and Lemon Grove, as well as many North County cities and unincorporated areas of the county in our rural desert and mountain regions, entirely at the mercy of San Diego. One need look no farther than the draining of Lake Morena to see what can happen when rural communities have no voice. While that's not a sand ag nor a transportation issue, that controversy involved the city of San Diego unilaterally deciding to drain Lake Morena down to just 5% of capacity, without ever asking San Diego residents to conserve water first. Drought later on reduced the lake's level to just 2.5% of capacity at one point. Despite vocal objections from the county, which owns a park around Lake Morena, and residents whose businesses, homes, wells, and property values were negatively affected, and environmentalists who were worried about wildlife, the city which owns the water rights drained Lake Morena anyhow, just because it could. San Diego also severely drained some other East County reservoirs without touching water levels in several reservoirs within San Diego's own city limits. When rains came, Otay's lower reservoir overflowed, sending precious water that originated at Lake Morena dumped out into the ocean. Similarly, county supervisors, each of whom represents just one portion of the county, have regularly foisted industrial-scale energy projects off on rural communities over the objection of East County's lone supervisor and rural residents who had to live with the projects. That's what can happen when local voices in East County have no power, or for that matter, North County or South County. One could envision future transportation decisions by a San Diego Chula Vista-controlled SANDAG that might result in saving money for urban projects by slashing already inadequate bus service to rural areas, or failing to advocate for improving safety or easing congestion along corridors traveled only by East County residents. Will bikeways along the San Diego River in East County or running a trolley line into North County ever even make it onto the agenda? Would trolley service to Santee ever have happened if the proposed new voting structure had been in place back then? If anything, East County's representation arguably needs strengthening, not weakening, since geographically our region is far more vast and transit options far more limited in the rural and mountain areas. Being without a car in most of East County can leave a person largely homebound or dependent on friends, neighbors, or costly options such as taxis, Uber, or Lyft. Not everyone opposes the AB 805, however. La Mesa Councilman Colin Parent, who is also a member of the Circulate San Diego group that advocates for transit-friendly transportation solutions, penned a memo in response to Councilwoman Alicio. Parent calls her analysis incomplete for La Mesa. While acknowledging that AB 805 might diminish the influence of most small cities, Parent concludes, "I believe that AB 805 is good for La Mesa." That's because La Mesa has many residents who commute to San Diego, Parent says, noting that La Mesa and San Diego also share numerous freeways and transit lines, such as Interstate 8, State Route 94, trolley and bus lines. He argues AB 805's proposed changes to the leadership structure of SANDAG would benefit La Mesa by shifting influence away from North County, which does not share common interests with La Mesa. He notes that the 2015 SANDAG Regional Plan proposes projects benefiting La Mesa, and nearly all of them travel through San Diego, so the interests are aligned. But Lemon Grove Councilman Jerry Jones shares Alicio's concerns. "The proposal to change SANDAG's structure is nothing but a power grab by a disgruntled Sacramento politician whose constituents didn't get their way," Jones wrote in a comment posted on a Voice of San Diego article, and that article had criticized SANDAG members for being quiet as crickets about the Prop A scandal. Jones likens the proposal to shift power away from small cities and communities on SANDAG to attempting to break up Congress, a move that would no doubt raise outrage were an effort to be made to stifle the voices of smaller states or rural communities across America. Jones concludes, "There are 17 cities in this county that chose to define their own path, good or bad, and Sacramento should not force the will of the city of San Diego and the Assembly District of Lorena Gonzalez-Fletcher on the rest of us." An outside audit of SANDAG over Prop A or other changes in future financial decision-making oversight to assure transparency would certainly be justifiable in serving the public's interest. However, taking away the voices of most cities in the region and from unincorporated rural, mountain, and desert areas in order to give total control of SANDAG to the two largest cities would clearly be detrimental to the interests of residents living in the vast majority of communities across San Diego County. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
If you're a smoker, the cost of many smoking products just went up effective April the 1st. That's because California voters approved Proposition 56, which increased the excise tax rate on cigarettes and expanded the definition of tobacco products to include any type of tobaccos, nicotine, little cigars, and electronic cigarettes sold in the combination with nicotine. The tax on a pack of cigarettes is now $2.87 a pack, more than triple the old tax rate of 87 cents. So a pack-a-day smoker would be spending nearly $90 a month on taxes, not counting the actual cost of the cigarettes. You will also pay a tax that's a whopping 27.3% of the wholesale cost of products defined as nicotine delivery devices, including electronic cigarettes, e-cigars, e-pipes, vape pens, and e-hookahs, if they are sold in combination with substances containing nicotine. Products such as nicotine patches, approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to help people quit smoking, are exempted from the new taxes. You can find more details about these new taxes on the State Board of Equalization's website. Or better yet, quit the habit and you'll save a lot of money, as well as protecting your health. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Gene Carpenter.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the Network for Social Justice. Today we are continuing our coverage of the race to replace Duncan Hunter, and today my very special guest is Gloria Chadwick. Gloria is a retired nurse who worked in the Veterans Administration VA hospital. She's a member of a proud military family, lots of folks in her family that have served in the armed services. And she is an elected member of the Grossmont Healthcare District, which serves virtually all of East County out here. She's also a talented and internationally known wildlife artist. Gloria, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. I'm really appreciative of being here. I wanted to thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to be here and talk to you about why I want to run for the 50th congressional district seat.
Thank you, Gloria. Well, it's certainly a pleasure to have you here. You made your announcement in a very unusual way. You made your announcement to run for office at Congressman Duncan Hunter's town hall, and afterward you were handing out these cute little pill bottles that had your remedy to fix Congress, including restoring integrity, providing affordable health care, creating more jobs, and protecting Medicare and the rights of veterans. And on the other side, it says, caution, avoid prolonged exposure to Congressman Duncan Hunter, who could be hazardous to your health. So obviously, you'd put some thought into this, Gloria. Can you give us a little bit of background about what led up to your decision to run for Congress?
During the course of the election, of course, I had my eyes set on visualizing a woman president. And so I was kind of focused that there would be a historic moment in time that I would like to be back in Washington, D.C. And as it turned out, that wasn't the historic moment I wanted. But it was still going to be very different because there was a new president in town who had no political background. So I thought, you know what, this is still a historic moment. So with family, my daughter and others, we went back to D.C. And I happened to take a red-eye flight so that I was there during the inauguration.
Really?
I wanted to take in the moment. This is history in the making. It's Donald Trump's inauguration. And it was a nice time for those that were there to support their Republican candidate. And it was pretty bleak. And it was very somber that day. And the next morning was the Women's March in D.C. And we were very much involved with that. It was startling with the contrast between the inauguration and the Women's March was just breathtaking. It was night and day. And I can tell you it was such a stimulating event.
Yeah, more people turned out for the Women's March than for the inauguration.
Absolutely. And in fact, the venue where the march was going to be faced the back of the White House so that the president could look out amongst the people. And this was significant because this is a president who has no political background. And this march was about lots of people with lots of viewpoints and lots of interest. And so he could look out from his White House and see all the people and all their concerns. The shocking thing is, when they got the permit, it was supposed to be for 200,000 people. By 9 o'clock in the morning, that was completely booked. Everything was packed. So in the end, there was close to 1.2 million people, and it stayed packed until about 5 o'clock.
Wow. So this was really a very dramatic turnout. Now, of course, Congressman Hunter was one of the early supporters of Donald Trump, endorsed him early on in the campaign, and has remained a staunch supporter of his, even through some very controversial actions that Trump has made as president. So fast forward to the town hall forum in Ramona that Congressman Hunter held, largely under pressure. There'd been protests at his office every week, and, you know, the protesters were holding signs up on bridges and things. So he finally decided to hold a town hall forum, and you were there. And tell us what happened next.
Yes, indeedy. I had already decided that I was going to go there and confront him. When I came back from that march, I was so enthused about our electoral process and that I felt I needed to do something, especially after reading the big article that came out in the Union Tribune.
There were a series of articles in which it was disclosed that Congressman Hunter was embroiled in campaign finance controversies, basically accused of using public funds. Campaign finance funds are matching funds, that's public money, for private gain to the tune of about $60,000. And of course, we know since the town hall, it's been confirmed that the Department of Justice is actually looking into this, and he could face actual criminal charges in addition to the FEC, which investigates fraud involving reporting on your campaign finances. So anyway, in the midst of all of this disclosure, you came to the town hall, and you were lucky enough to get your name pulled to go up and ask a question, and that's where you made your announcement that you were running for Congress.
That's right. I told him that because of his corrupt behavior, he did not deserve to represent us, and that I am going to run against him in 2018. And a lot of this has to do with the fact that I've held elected office for the last 18 years with Grossmont Healthcare District, and every 4 years I've run for office. The constituency is 500,000. The area covers 750 square miles. All of us that hold elected office do not need to be represented by the likes of Duncan Hunter. We understand what campaign money is. That's precious money that our constituents have given to us to enable us to do good works for them.
And we should note here that you've gotten, I think, 60,000 votes in your last election. So that's a substantial number of votes, I guess all or mostly all within the same boundaries that the 50th Congressional District includes. Is that correct?
Yes, although the district has moved up into the North County area. So folks perhaps are not as familiar with me, but I do hope to engage them. And as a registered nurse, I'm a patient advocate. A patient advocate is really your warrior for you when you are ill. And this is something that our representative should be doing for all of us, regardless of our political party. The Constitution begins with we the people, and they set aside a system where we would have representation for all of the people. And that's our elected representatives in Congress.
So one of the most controversial issues that we've seen in the news lately has been what to do about health care reform. On the one side, we've had the Republicans saying Obamacare has to be repealed, or the Affordable Care Act, which is the proper name for the act, Duncan Hunter was all for that at his town hall. He stood up and said that he does not believe health care should be a guaranteed right, that you should just have access. And he stood by that even when one gentleman got up there and said, well, I can have access to a first-class ticket on an airplane, but if I can't afford it, what good does it do me? But he was still quite supportive of what I would call Trump care, the Republican plan that finally failed. And now we have the President Trump saying, you know, Obamacare is going to implode. On the other hand, although Trump care, had it gone through, would have kicked 24 million people off of insurance, and it would have raised rates in some cases by 4 or 5 fold, particularly for seniors. So, you know, it would create a new set of problems. It really didn't seem like it was improving health care or making it more accessible or affordable for hardly anybody, and it would make it less accessible, more unaffordable for many. But then on the other hand, we have Democrats who have been so focused on, we've got to protect Obamacare, we can't let it be repealed, that they've kind of had blinders on, I think, to some of the problems. Certainly, although it helped many, many, many people get health care who couldn't before, it improved coverage, did a lot of good things. There are some holes. There's certainly people that are paying more. So I'm curious, as a nurse and as an elected member of the Grossmont Healthcare District, you've certainly seen, I would imagine, you know, the good, the bad, and everything else when it comes to the healthcare system. What do you believe is the best solution, and what do you believe might be the most workable solutions? Those aren't necessarily the same things, but what should be done about healthcare?
Well, as painful as it may sound to the parties, the individuals, the representatives from both parties actually have to acknowledge that there is a problem, and they have to come to grips with figuring out how to find the solution. And I can tell you, on our nonpartisan board, it's Democrats and Republicans working together on regular routine basis, and we come up with solutions that are the best interest of the people that live in our district.
And the patients that go to the healthcare district.
Absolutely. Yeah. For the patients, it's a wonderful hospital. You know that it is under a lease agreement that was entered into in 1991 with Sharp. Mm-hmm. And Sharp does do the actual management of the hospital. But the district engaged the community in a bond measure, Prop G. And we, at the end of our project now, with a $247 million project, that's really beneficial for the community. And this was voted on by Democrats and Republicans to do the best thing for our community. And this is what people have to keep in mind. And we can't be just a group of parties, this party versus that party, because we're never going to get anything done. There are problems with Obamacare. It's done fabulous things as far as the getting a measure forward. You have to realize that the Affordable Care Act was carried about for about 18 months. It was a 1,000-page document, and it took a lot of talking, finessing to get it to where it is today.
Yeah, Trump famously said he didn't know healthcare was complicated.
That's
it's
right.
It's kind of hard to believe how you can not think it would be a complicated subject.
Right. But the idea that you can just steamroll something through and it will be fine, that's not a solution.
What are some of the things you've seen? Let's start with the good on Obamacare. What are some of the things that you've seen through the healthcare district in terms of how has it impacted not only the patients, but also the hospital and the doctors? I mean, I know before it passed, there seemed to be a lot of resistance and fear of what's this going to do, but how has it really worked out in the long run?
Well,
and do the people that you know there, what do they think about, you know, repealing?
I mean, I think that within every group, you know, there's always that group that says, well, we've got it and we're going to have to live with it. And that's sort of the beginning when it started. But the doctors have found out that the patients that are coming in now, they're actually not at the degree of severity as mm-hmm. they were before. Because now you have people who are getting notices from their insurance company because they can actually have insurance. And insurance companies are very good about telling their patients when to get their shots, what kind of diets to have if they're diabetic, mm-hmm. and all of this preventative care and maternity care. And if you take all of that away, you're going to go back to the dark ages where people are going to wait until the last minute.
Yeah.
They're going to be too ill when they come in, and that's a huge impact on the hospitals.
Well, also hospitals now under Obamacare, they have, a lot of people don't know, they have to actually report on outcomes. And so
yes.
we're now finding out if there's a hospital that has some problems, maybe a high infection rate or high number of deaths from a particular cause, and then they're incentivized to go in and fix those things. So aren't we actually seeing the overall quality of care improve? I mean, even in an already good hospital like Grossmont, did they find room for improvement under
Obamacare? Oh, yeah, absolutely. Grossmont has won several awards mm-hmm. for infection control. Standards are going up and up. They have been excellent.
So that said, obviously we have both seen that Obamacare is not perfect. Where are the areas, you know, if there's somebody out there listening who maybe had a bad experience on Obamacare, what are some of the solutions? What are some of the areas that you would like to see improved?
I would like to see us find the solutions to bring down the cost for our middle class people,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's most of us.
Yeah.
And where these gaps are, there has to be a solution. To just let it die and implode and the prices skyrocket is not going to help any of us.
Yeah.
It is a good program. It is providing good care. And I should also tell you that with the Affordable Care Act, there was all of this angst that they were going to have too many patients. They wouldn't be able to see them.
Did that
so,
happen?
And it's not a problem. What it did, it created lots and lots of jobs for the health industry. And what's going to happen or was predicted by Milken Institute School of Public Health in a January Forbes issue, they predicted that if the Trump care bill went through, there would be a loss of jobs to the tune of about 2.6 million jobs by the year 2019.
Wow. And that would include a lot locally here, I would assume.
Oh, absolutely. You have to realize all of the different entities that are involved in running a hospital. A hospital is like a little mini universe with a variety of jobs, a variety of providers.
Sure. There is, of course, another solution that some have advocated for, including Bernie Sanders, and that is going to a universal healthcare type system, such as we see in, well, most other developed countries of the world, particularly in Europe. What are your thoughts about that? Is that something that you would support if you believed it could actually get through Congress? And then, of course, the second part is it realistic?
We are the greatest nation. Don't you think we should have the greatest care? And yes, we should be providing for all of our citizens. As far as a single payer system right now, that would be the VA.
That's true. And how well did it work?
You worked it works there. Pretty darn good. And I would hate to think that it would be privatized. Anytime you start privatizing something, you're going to lose the essence of it.
And yeah, Duncan Hunter has certainly been an advocate for privatization of all sorts of things, for everything from, you know, post office to private prison. Some of these things we're seeing go through Congress. What are the problems with privatizing the VA? I mean, if it's working well and it's providing good quality of care in most cases for our active duty military as well as for our veterans, why would anybody want to privatize it?
The bottom line in privatization is profits. And we want to see a reinvestment in our care, in our equipment. It's not about giving back to the stockholders.
So do you think that privatization then would have the opposite, that it would wind up with not much money invested in improving the quality of care and the equipment and
yes.
the testing and the doctors, that instead it's just going to be somebody pocketing the corporate masters of it, basically pocketing the profits at the expense of our military veterans' health care and their families?
Yes, and that's what you see with some private hospitals, that what happens, they start cutting out services that are not profitable.
So you support the idea of single-payer health care, but obviously that's going to be a tough sell through Congress unless we get an awful lot of seats changing hands back there, I think, in coming elections. In terms of what might actually be doable, I'm curious, one of the big issues, you know, when I talk to people, whether they're in the Tea Party or the Occupy group or Indivisible or whatever, the one thing everybody's complaining about is the high cost of prescription drug prices. You know, my mother, she takes heart and blood pressure medicine. It used to be a couple hundred dollars a month, and all of a sudden it's like $1,500 or $2,000 a month, and she just comes back in tears from the pharmacy. What is the answer to that? If we don't do single payer, is there something that can or should be done in the interim to protect people, particularly sick people and old people who are spending more than they can afford or simply doing without life-saving drugs because they don't have the money?
Well, there's really no reason why we can't be negotiating down our cost. That's actually what happens with the VA system.
Yeah.
You know, some people get a little nervous because the blue pill that they were taking for so long is now a yellow pill and might change to a different color. But all it has to do with is purchasing from the company that they can get the best deal on. And there's no reason why we can't go. There was a time when they thought they could negotiate with Canada. Mm-hmm. That was eliminated.
Yeah.
But why can't we?
Well, we could if Congress would agree. Basically,
that's
it was
right.
Because you just had people who, let's face it, they get an awful lot of donations from the pharmaceutical industry, and the pharmaceutical industry profits off being able to keep those prices as high as they want to, as high as they can get away with. And so, unfortunately, that definitely seems to be an area where money is talking in Congress, and it's not in the interest of the consumer.
That's true.
Let's talk about our military and our veterans. You've had a lot of them in your own family there, I understand. Your parents and your son, I understand.
Yes, I'm very pro-military because that's how I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, working at the VA and being associated with all of our hard-working veterans, I sometimes am chagrined that Congress wants to force something down the throats of the military that I'm not so sure they want.
Can you give us an example?
Well, in the past, there have been purchases or bills for boats or ships or
models where the general said we don't want it or the Pentagon said we don't want it. And some lucrative defense contractor, again,
exactly.
Put a lot of money in the pocket of members of Congress and something gets through, not because it's
exactly
necessarily the best, but because it's, you know,
exactly
the best lobbyists.
And right now, my concerns are, I understand President Trump would like to build the military, and there's lots of money for new ships and new planes. But you know who really needs the money are our ground troops. They need to have the best equipment. Why are we sending young soldiers forward when we have the capability of having drones to keep them out of harm's way? There's got to be technology that will make our ground troops safer. And that's where I would like to see any dollars spent, as well as the funding for our families that are in the military, their children, their housing, their education.
Do you think that Congress should exert a little bit more oversight on presidential actions that escalate military involvement overseas? We haven't had a formal declaration of war by Congress since, I believe, World War II, or way back when. We've had all these engagements in Iraq and now ground troops going into Syria under President Trump. As a member of Congress, what would be the factors you would look at in determining whether or not it's the right time to send our men and women into a warlike situation?
Well, that would certainly be something worth serious investigating and checking out all of the facts. Before moving forward, it would have to be a very serious conversation and discussion amongst all.
So in other words, there's a big difference between, say, a self-defense situation like Pearl Harbor versus
yes.
when President Bush decided on his doctrine of, you know, first strike when we hadn't been attacked and there was no real threat,
right.
For example, in Iraq, because he thought or claimed they had weapons of mass destruction that turned out not to really be there. That maybe Congress should exert a little more oversight in situations like that to make sure that they really see.
I believe they should, and I believe
facts.
That the evidence that they see should be clear. I believe that when that period of time was going on, we relied too much on statements from others rather than Congress actually reviewing all of the facts.
Doing its due diligence, yeah. I would like to talk about the care of our veterans when they come home. So many of them are coming back suicidal. Suicide rates are skyrocketing. Rates of homelessness are skyrocketing. You asked an intriguing question of Congressman Hunter at that town hall, and you've told me that you didn't really feel that he answered it. Can you repeat the question for our listeners?
I asked him what was going to be done with our veterans that had separated from the military for other reasons. And the point that I was getting at is that we do have veterans who have been in the service for quite a long period of time, and they separated from the military for other reasons.
In other words, you're talking about a dishonorable discharge, for example?
Or? But they still served our country.
Yeah.
They did do service for our country. And unfortunately for them, they are on the outside along with everybody else who's going to fall in the gaps of not having any insurance coverage.
So they could come back with a service-related disability for serving our country, PTSD or injuries or something like that, or illnesses that maybe form after many years from exposure to chemicals, cancers, and they have no coverage through the VA because they made one mistake and got themselves dishonorably discharged even after decades of service. You've talked about how things used to be different in an earlier generation, that more veterans were covered than are today. Is that correct?
Yes. Both of my parents were in the Navy. They talked about the promises that the government had made. And this is true. When young men and women signed up for the military, there were always benefits and things that were there for them. Over the course of time, Congress seems to adjust and take things away. This is unfair for our servicemen and women. If we have made commitments to them, we should keep them. It wasn't too long ago, well, maybe it was, but Balboa Hospital would be the hospital that any serviceman could go to. Then it turned out that it was only for those in active military, and the other veterans would go to the VA. Now the VA is only service-connected. So
it's a whittling down of the benefits that people were promised when they enrolled in the past, and you think that should be honored?
I think it should be honored. They made a commitment. When we make a commitment to something, we should honor that.
Do you believe that Duncan Hunter's voting record when it comes to really supporting military families and veterans has been all that it should be? He is, of course, an Iraq and Afghanistan war veteran himself.
He's had a mixed voting record with that.
Should more be done to assist homeless veterans and those who are coming home with mental health conditions?
Absolutely. That is something that the veterans administration, I'm sure, is working on. That has been an issue. I know I've participated in the stand down event that they have every year for the homeless, and our homelessness in our country is something that we have to do something about.
Do you think that the federal government should be leading the effort on this, at least with regard to homelessness among our veterans?
Absolutely.
I mean, we've got a guy coming on the show next week who was a veteran who found himself homeless within a month from coming back from one of these recent wars, and eventually started a business and got back on his feet. But I was kind of shocked that somebody could wind up homeless 1 month after you get back, that there wasn't any support network really for even a very recent combat veteran.
That's true. It's very sad to see our veterans like that, and I would support anything that we can do to make our homeless better. But I must also say that in the healthcare arena as well, we did an injustice to our homeless, our mentally ill patients when we closed Camarillo down. Mm. Camarillo was changed.
Was that a federal facility?
No, that was a state. That was done under Ronald Reagan.
So you're talking about when they closed the mental hospitals?
Yes.
And they released a lot
of patients. They're still out there. We need to do something for them.
Yeah. So you would support better care and support services for the mentally ill as well as the homeless.
Right.
Of all sorts. Okay. Let's move on. Now, as a wildlife painter, fabulous artist, by the way, I've seen your work. It's beautiful. You've been involved in educating people on environmental issues. What do you think about Duncan Hunter's voting record on the environment?
Duncan Hunter's voting record is zero.
As bad as it can get.
It's as bad as it can get. And I think he's got 2% over an 8-year period. But one of the worst is this current bill, which was a House Resolution number 69, and this bill allows for recreational shooting. This is not hunting, it is shooting. And it covers 76 million acres in Alaska.
This is federal public land that's supposed to be a wildlife refuge.
Right. and the shooters may go in and shoot mother bears with their cubs while they're hibernating.
In their dens. Yeah.
Pull wolf cubs out of their dens.
Brutal.
And chase down bears or any predator with a helicopter and shoot them.
And this now, just doesn't seem even very sporting, let alone...
It's not sporting.
It's inhumane.
It's not sporting. It's something that would make John Muir and Theodore Roosevelt roll over in their graves.
Yeah, this I mean, Theodore just... Roosevelt, of course, founded the national park system and the national forest system. He was a Republican back in the days when Republicans seemed to stand up for conserving our natural resources, yes, instead of, unfortunately, nowadays, most of them in Congress seem to be more interested in exploiting those resources. So Duncan Hunter supported this bill.
Yes.
And he's also supported, very proudly, he spoke about it at his town hall meeting, about voting to eliminate, not weaken, not, you know, trim funding, eliminate the Environmental Protection Agency that was established under Richard Nixon, another Republican president, for the purposes of protecting the public from polluted air, polluted water, chemical contaminants all over. I mean, you know, let's go back in time. At the time that passed, we had rivers so polluted that they were catching on fire. We had, you know, deformities in wildlife and pelicans going extinct because their eggs would break from the DDT, and children being born with all kinds of problems when they were, you know, the mothers were exposed to these things.
And that's exactly right. Our national bird, the big bald eagle, was almost extinct because of those very facts. And in fact, Rachel Carson's book, The Silent Spring, was the call that we needed to do something about the environment. And so when Nixon signed that bill in 1970, mm-hmm, it was a wonderful beginning. And it's just a disaster to think that Trump wants to allow Mr. Pruitt to close this down, to shut it down. Even China has patterned its newest regulations after our own EPA. So we are looked up to about how we've done such a wonderful job cleaning up our environment. Yes. And now you have this group who wants to just tear it down so that they can profit and put us all in harm's way.
I imagine as a nurse, you know, through the many years that you've had that career, you must have seen some cases of this come in, haven't you? People who were harmed in the old days before we had an EPA from some of these things.
Oh, sure. You still have patients with asbestosis. Mm-hmm. They were exposed to asbestos over our building periods during the 50s and the 60s. And then even as late as, I guess it was the late 70s, I was involved with some lung, UCSD, UCLA, and a couple of other campuses that were doing research on the air quality in Alpine. Because at the time, Alpine's air really wasn't that good.
Alpine, where Duncan Hunter grew up, his father lived there.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You can see the difference in the air quality. It used to be when you drove up to Los Angeles, you could see the thick, dense smog. And now that's something that young generations now just cannot appreciate.
Yeah, I actually used to have allergic reactions. I went to school at UC Santa Barbara in the 70s. And I can remember, I mean, just driving through LA, even with the windows up, the smell and of the air and that chemical, your eyes would be stinging and burning and watering and your throat would hurt from it. And, you know, in recent years, you go up there and it's not nearly as bad. It's so much better. And even El Cajon, you could remember days where there would just be a pall of this, smog hanging over the valley. And we don't have that anymore. That's what the EPA did for us.
Right. And in fact, we used to have air alerts. It would tell you the quality of the air,
yeah,
and it would tell you if you had an asthmatic, mm-hmm, child or somebody, yeah, with a heart condition, that they were not to be outside.
Yeah, I remember going outside in LA one time where I worked and literally passing out. I had to be revived by paramedics, and it was just because of breathing the air. That's how bad it was.
It was.
There.
So why would we want to go back?
Good question, Gloria. On another issue that's very controversial in, of course, and in the news these days is immigration reforms. I'm wondering if you can tell us what you think about the Trump stances that, of course, Congressman Hunter supports as far as the wall and also these mass deportations of immigrants. And by the way, it's not just criminals being targeted. We're hearing lots and lots of cases of people who don't have criminal backgrounds that are still being deported. Let's start with the border wall. What are your views about the wall? How do we, on the one hand, you know, protect ourselves against maybe would-be terrorists or perhaps people who might have criminal backgrounds who want to come across that border versus just people who are coming here looking for a job in America? You know, poor people that are coming here to work as picking crops or doing landscaping work, that sort of thing.
My personal opinion is no stinking wall. Our first governor in California was Mexican. We are enriched by our neighbor, by all of the cultural things that we are benefiting from. We love Mexico.
We used Mexico, to be part of Mexico. Yeah.
We support it. You know, who is going to come over here and pick all our crops? They are very hard, hardworking people. I deplore the idea of having any kind of wall whatsoever. It's not good for the environment. It's not good for animals that migrate back and forth.
That's
true. It's not safe for the Border Patrol agents or those in Mexico. I think that if we were given the possibility, I would like to see the Border Patrol agents and the Mexican government work together collaboratively to come up with a solution of how they think that they can best protect the borders.
So you think there's ways to keep out, say, the drug cartel members smuggling across the border without keeping everybody else out?
Absolutely. Look at all the tunnels that we've had over the years. The wall hasn't done anything to prevent the tunnels from being built.
Mm-hmm. And there are sensors and things they can use too, and cameras, so they can see if you've got, you know, a bunch of people with guns coming across and backpacks and full of drugs or something.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. What about the deportation policies where we're seeing quite an increase that actually increased under Obama, but now under President Trump, it's going further. And we're now even seeing these stories of mothers who, there was a case recently of a mother who had been here for many, many years. Her only crime was when she first came across the border years ago, making a false statement to get a job on some job application form. And now she's being deported. And her children, who are citizens who were born here, who are like 10, 12 years old, are being left here with no mother.
I don't agree with any of that. You know, all of us in this country, except for the Native American Indians, come from immigrants. I can't see the benefit of trying to deport all of these poor people who have been here. Yes, under the Obama years, there was a high rate of deportation. But if there are criminals or if there's a reason that they should be deported.
You would support that.
I would support that. Mm-hmm. But to take these innocent people who have been here and they are paying taxes. Every time they purchase something, they are paying taxes.
Correct. And actually, if we took people out of the shadows to where there was a legal way, either through a work permit process or actually giving them citizenship, but somewhere where they could be here, the ones that are already here could be acknowledged and working and also paying income taxes. Some do, but they have to use a false ID to do it, and others are getting cash under the table. There's still a lot of that that goes on. I know that it goes on.
Yes.
In East County, I've had a lot of people tell me about stores that do that and farms, some of them, that do that. Wouldn't it go a long way toward fixing our deficit problem if we simply figured out a way to let those people that are already here let them pay taxes and collect it?
Exactly. And let's not forget that it was Ronald Reagan who capitulated to the vineyards in Northern California mm-hmm. to actually bring in as many workers as they could at the time.
That was the Braceros program, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, it made a lot of sense in some ways.
Right. So, and those, I'm sure there are generations of people from that era, and they're still here.
I've had the head of the San Diego County Farm Bureau, who's about as red as you can get in a lot of ways, I'm sure, very conservative in many ways, but they are very, very concerned about these deportation policies and the crackdown on immigration. You know, they're worried they're going to have crops just rotting in the fields. and nobody to pick them. It's not
exactly.
Like, those aren't jobs that a lot of Americans are, they're not going to drop everything and run to the Central Valley to pick crops.
Nope.
I know what you mean. It's easy to say, well, give the jobs to Americans, but that's been tried and there just weren't enough of them, you know, in the past, at least willing to take those jobs, particularly since these aren't in urban areas. It means you've got to travel out to the rural areas to do the work and it's only seasonal and not everybody's willing to do that.
It's seasonal and it's really, really hard physical work.
True.
And, this is something that, if they're able to come and do this for us, this is great. If we get rid of all of them, the price of food is going to skyrocket. And you're right. Those fields will be bare.
Where do you stand, Gloria? We've talked a little bit about your opposition to this new bill that would allow people to go in and basically murder, gun down and kill bear cubs and wolf cubs in their dens. But where do you stand on hunting in general? And beyond that, on Second Amendment rights, I'm sure I can just hear my conservative listeners out there wondering what your answer is on that one.
The Second Amendment is here. The Second Amendment stands. I do talks regarding the relationship between hunters, conservation, and wildlife artists.
Yeah, I understand that in a lot of places, hunters are actually teaming up with environmentalists now, for example, to purchase habitat. On the one hand, it seems like a conflict because hunters want to shoot animals and environmentalists like to protect them. But if there's no habitat, then everybody recognizes it's a lose-lose for everyone. And so they're working together to expand and protect habitat while allowing some hunting in the appropriate areas.
Exactly. And that's like the Ducks Unlimited. It started that way. And actually, there aren't that many duck hunters like there used to be, but the land has been preserved. The birds have been kept from extinction, and so everyone benefits from it. Hunting as a hunter, I support. Shooting simply to shoot, I do not.
Yeah, so if it's going and gunning down animals in their den, that goes too far. Where do you stand more broadly on gun ownership for self-defense? I guess on the one hand, we have people who want to restrict gun ownership, and on the other, we have Congress voting to allow mentally ill people to own guns.
It's about sensible gun laws. As a psychiatric nurse, I can tell you the idea that they just passed a bill allowing anyone with severe mental illnesses that they may indeed have the right to purchase a gun just seems very nutty to me. That's probably our third question when we're interviewing patients who have been brought in by the police, who are homicidal, hearing voices. Do you have a gun? Do you have access to a gun? And where is that gun?
So under this bill, the law enforcement wouldn't be able to go in and get that gun if someone's hearing voices that tells them they need to go and shoot people?
I believe that what the bill is saying, that those people would not be put on a list as acknowledged to have had a disability that would discriminate them from buying a gun.
So they can get out of the hospital and walk across the street to the gun shop and they're good to go.
That's my understanding of it, and I'm totally, completely, thoroughly opposed to that.
Yeah, it kind of makes you wonder, question the sanity of some in Congress at times,
yes.
Doesn't it?
Yes.
Okay. Well, we've certainly had a lot to talk about today, Gloria. Listeners, if you've just tuned in, we have been speaking with Gloria Chadwick, who is a retired Veterans Administration nurse, VA nurse. She's an elected member of the Grossmont Healthcare District Board, a talented, internationally known wildlife artist, and she is running for Congress as a Democrat against Congressman Duncan Hunter in the 50th Congressional District. Gloria, let me ask you this. This is definitely going to be a tough race. We're already hearing from as many as 10, maybe even 12, some say, candidates lining up to run against Congressman Hunter. And that's just on the Democratic side of the aisle. We don't know how many other Republicans may come out, especially if it should become an open seat. Should he be forced to resign or possibly even be facing criminal charges or convicted by the time the 2018 election comes about, since there is a confirmed Department of Justice investigation against him over his alleged misuse of campaign finance donations for personal purposes. So I have to ask you, what makes you think that you are the one who is tough enough to beat out a pack of 10 or 12 Democrats and then in a general election, Hunter or whoever the Republicans have running, as well as to stand up against all that special interest money in Washington, D.C., should you be elected?
Well, I've been elected 5 times for this seat that I hold every 4 years, and I am, by occupation, a patient advocate. A patient advocate, as a nurse, stands up and fights for their patient. It's the nurse warrior in me.
I love
that
term.
I'm not afraid of anybody, and I'm not afraid to stand up to somebody about my patient. I don't care what the administration says or a doctor. If my patient needs care, my patient gets care. As a representative, the constituents need to be represented by somebody who will stand up for their rights and to listen to all of them, whether they're Republican, Independent, Democrats. You have to represent everyone, and you have to be brave enough to stand up for the rights of all of the people that you represent. And I believe that I'm the person, I'm the nurse warrior that can do that.
Okay.
So I thank you.
Well, very good. Gloria, if people want to get more information about your candidacy, where can they go?
My webpage is GloriaChadwickForCongress.com, and I am in the formative stage right now since we just announced, and we will be adding things as we go. And I thank you so much for having me.
Well, you're welcome, and we certainly appreciate you joining us today on the East County Magazine Show. I'm KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
This is Jim Brewster with a product safety alert. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration announced that 13 lots of Mylan's EpiPen and EpiPen Jr. are being voluntarily recalled. EpiPen injections provide emergency doses of epinephrine to treat life-threatening allergic reactions. According to the FDA, the recall is due to defective parts that may result in the devices failing to activate. The recalled lots were distributed nationwide between December 17, 2015 and July 1, 2016. Lot numbers of the affected devices may be found on the FDA website at fda.gov.
Ford's popular F-250 pickup trucks can shift into gear when parked and roll away, Ford Motor Company has announced. The company is recalling 52,000 of these trucks. The trucks in the recall were built in Kentucky between October 2015 and March 2017 and were sold across North America. Ford is offering free repairs on automatic transmissions in the recalled vehicles. In the meantime, owners of Ford F-250 6.2-liter model pickup trucks are advised to always use the parking brake to prevent parked vehicles from moving while in park. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fistier.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Liz Alper, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.